find the same, the same
arguments are still there. It's still the same arguments. So. Yes. Yeah, I think it, yeah. So, yeah, so the question is about, are there parts of like medicine, or I'd say even other sciences, that are less impacted by evolution or more? I mean, I think I said this, that, you know, people talk about how evolution is foundation to all of your understanding of science. I totally don't agree with that. Because, you know, you can learn all of that science without evolution. Evolution is a philosophy about where things came from. And it changes how you interpret maybe where genes came from or how things are related. It doesn't do anything for function or structure or dysfunction. And so you can learn all of that. Now, if you're going to, you know, do a PhD in biology or molecular biology, you're probably going to end up having to deal with that more than, say, in like a medical field or an engineering field. Just by nature of that science. And so I think it gets more challenging. It's easier in medicine to say, well, I don't buy any of that. And it affects my job zero. What I find is in medicine, people tend to genuflect. Do you guys know what genuflect means? It means like bow. If you've ever been to a Catholic church, they bow to the host, to the bread, because that's the body of Christ. And you see the priest, he bows, he genuflects. That's what people do in the literature. They genuflect to evolution. They put their evolutionary blah, 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 and then they do their science. And then they put a little evolutionary blah, blah, blah at the end, because that's what you do if you want to be accepted. And if you don't do that, you know, you don't do that. You don't, in medicine, you don't have to do that. So I think medicine, it's crazy to try and like talk about evolution. It's like, oh, look at the immune system that evolved. I'm like, the immune system evolved? Oh my gosh. So yeah.
I have a friend who's really into science, and he really just sees science as a way to discover truth and a way to experience just wonder about the world. So I don't think it would come across very well to him to say, one, there's bias in science, and just the glasses you see it through changes what you think of things. I think he would see that and just kind of offends it because he just sees science as just this wonderful thing. So how do you kind of present that to somebody who doesn't think there's bias, who just thinks scientists are a bunch of people looking
for? Yeah. Well, in some ways they are, right? I mean, it's like that study about Archaeopteryx. The science of that, I'm going to use UV light to like try and see soft tissue structures. That's a great idea. That is great science. And so that is really cool. And that is really exciting. What's interesting is what you do after that, because it's like, what story do you tell with that science? It's not the science that's the problem, because the science is really cool. It is really interesting. That's really clever. But, and so I think you can be very sort of agreement that, wow, that's really cool. The question is, what does that point to, and why do you think it points to that? Because again, the science part of it is interesting. It is cool. It is clever. It is discovering, you know, truths. Like, did Archaeopteryx have these bird-like structures? Yeah, that's true. That's great. That's legit science. It's when you start to put the evolutionary glasses on and say, Archaeopteryx is this transitional fossil that proves this theory of evolution. And that's where I think you can ask questions about, well, why do you think that fits into evolution? Why do you think that's not just a bird? Sure looks like a lot of bird structures to me. What about, you know, and that's where I think trying to do a little digging and finding information that can just sort of say, well, that doesn't really fit as a transitional because of, you know, the things I talked about. So yeah, I don't want to, and that's the thing, I don't want to poke holes in science as a whole. I think we have enough science doubters in the world already, some in our government, not to editorialize. Sorry, that probably offended some people. But I'm in infectious disease, it's what we do. And so I think it's good to not just say, well, science is out. And that would be the wrong approach to this. What we have to do is take what's good in science and say, yeah, because it, that stuff points to our amazing creator. And it's all about, the glasses you put on. And I think just helping people to understand the glasses that they're looking through. Because that's the model they've been taught. That's how they grew up. That's the worldview that everyone who goes through school is steeped in. And so, you know, people, and it took me a while even, just you're like, oh yeah, I see that. So, and I think that's what we can do, is help people to see that's the glasses they're looking through. There's an alternative you could think about. Man, this seems really crazy. How could this happen by chance? I'm just trying to imagine it. It seems really impossible. So, great question, yeah.
You mentioned a little bit about different types of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you respond to somebody who says, well, everyone always says everything changes?
Yes.
God's evolved.
Yes. So, yes. That's a great topic. So that's where it's really about different types of evolution. So that's where it's important when people say, I believe in evolution, to clarify what they mean by evolution. Because would I believe that, you know, you can start from one set of dog and get to a whole bunch of different other kinds of dogs, one set of cat, can finches change their beak shape? Absolutely. That happens. That's a very different, and many people call that microevolution. That's very different than a molecules demand evolution, which is the evolutionary viewpoint that we started with self-replicating molecules that became LUCA that differentiated into everything you see. And so it's good to clarify, because I can say, well, I believe that things change over time. Who doesn't believe that things change over time? And that was actually one of the problems back when Darwin was around, was that there was this dogmatic view that God had created all the species and they were static and they didn't change, which is not a biblical view. That's just a view people had at that time. And things did change. And they were discovering dinosaur fossils, things that they'd never seen before. Like, where did all this come from? And so this idea that was kind of non-biblical, that species never change and God created each species, was really getting upended by the, like, expanding scientific world of what people were finding. And so I feel super comfortable saying I believe in microevolution, change over time, things adapt to their, you know, their set. God is, I think God built that adaptability into animals. And that, again, I think makes it even cooler that God took all these animals, he built this adaptability. It says Noah took one of every kind of animal. And so what's a kind? Well, he probably took one dog kind animal. And that one dog kind animal has now differentiated into foxes and wolves and, you know, wild dogs in Africa and domestic dogs and all the different dingoes and all the different dog types we see, because those can kind of breed back. And it is a little hard sometimes to tell what's a kind and what's a species. But I have no problem with that. But that's not the molecules demand evolution, which is what most, which is what Christians have a problem with, is the molecules demand evolution. Yes.
How do you approach the conversation between Christian beliefs and evolution? I understand that it's more of a theory issue where, like,
yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of Christians who believe in evolution. And they're absolutely Christians. There are a lot of great people who believe in an old earth. And there's a lot of, and I didn't talk about this, there's a lot of sort of in-between views. There are Christian evolutionists, there are progressive creationists, there are lots of different views in there. I think the questions become, how do you view the first couple chapters of Genesis? And I didn't go through some of these other theological implications, because in the first couple of chapters of Genesis, we have the establishment of male and female. What are the genders? We have the establishment of marriage defined between man and a woman. We have the origin of sin, and the need for redemption from sin. And so I think those are major theological issues. And I don't think you want to, like, grind axes with those people. I think it's just good for people to understand, hey, here's why I think this way. I think these are some of the issues. If I don't think Genesis, 1-3 really happened, I'm going to have a hard time saying man and woman should be married. Now, they say that later, but what does Jesus refer back to? He refers back to Genesis. What did Paul refer back to? he refers back to Genesis. When Peter's referring to judgment, what does he refer back to? He refers back to the flood. And so these guys all saw that as actual history. And if we're going to say it's evolution, I think some people just haven't thought about the implications of accepting that. And so it's good for people to just think about that. And, you know, I don't want to, like, grind axes and make people feel like they're not Christians. I think you just have to think, well, boy, when someone says, can a man get married to a man? And they say, well, why do you believe that? You say, well, God created marriage between a man and a woman when he created the first man and woman. And that's the foundation for it. That's how God created it. That was what people did later on, but they did that because that was a pattern established at the very beginning. And so that, I mean, that's kind of my approach, is not to be like, I mean, you don't want to rub people in it. But I think it's just good for people to understand that. I agree, it's not a salvation issue, but there are a lot of, I think, major cultural issues sitting on Genesis. And I think there's a reason that Darwinism happened before this whole cultural revolution, because it set the foundation for removing all of it. That's just my opinion. So, other questions?
I feel like the average Christian church maybe doesn't necessarily look deeply into these questions of Genesis, questions about evolution versus creation, about a younger.
Why do people not look into this deeply and as churches? I think that's a good question. I think people can be intimidated by it. I think it's, as someone who's in science, I'm less intimidated by it, but I think it's easy for people who, you know, who don't have a scientific background to feel intimidated by it and to sort of defer to experts. There are Christians out there, and there are a number of many theological seminaries where that's what they teach. They teach evolution, they teach progressive creationism. There aren't a ton out there, this is my understanding, that are strong standards on Genesis. And when they're, you know, particularly when there's maybe differing opinions on this, some people can get kind of unhappy, you know. So, but I think a lot of it is just people aren't comfortable with the science, and they don't maybe feel like they can speak about it. Which I think we should be comfortable. I mean, God's word is clear. We feel comfortable talking about everything else in God's word. I think it's important to work through these things as a church, and I think it's important for us to sort through them. Because again, for me, I think it's foundational to making those arguments about marriage, gender roles, sin. Genesis is the foundation for all of that. And so if you don't have your foundation, you're just not as strong in having those discussions. So, but that's an opinion. I don't, you know, there's probably many reasons. Other questions? No. Yeah, I mean, so if one, yeah, so the question was if, you know, if we say that the first 12 chapters of Genesis isn't true, does that, the argument was that doesn't invalidate the rest of it. And I think, I mean, yeah, I think it does make us starting to ask questions. I mean, the thing about the Bible is the Bible claims to be written by God. And the Bible claims that all of it is true and accurate. I mean, you know, Jesus said none of it's going to pass away. Not a jot or a tittle, right? Which is like the smallest little letter. And so, you know, that is the Bible. It cuts at the, is the Bible infallible? And, you know, is it an all or nothing? I think it raises a lot of questions. I mean, could the rest of the Bible be right and the first 12 chapters wrong? Yeah, but everybody else in the Bible sure thought the first 12 chapters were what happened, and that's how they operated based on that knowledge. So, and you know, I think I forgot to quote this verse. If you read in Exodus, when God lays out the Ten Commandments, and he lays out the Sabbath, he says, you know, 6 days you're going to work, 1 day you're going to rest, because in 6 days I created the earth and 1 day I rested. And God wrote that. That's like God is writing that down on a tablet. And so God seems to have thought it was 6 days and said, that's why I'm going to have you do that. And so to me, that seems to say, boy, if God in Exodus, which would be the part that maybe, you know, boy, if we're getting to Exodus and that's questionable, really getting into the Bible is very questionable. If that's accurate, then, you know, so I think to me, it's kind of got to all hang together, or it all starts to just get really mushy and shaky ground. So, but a great question. Yeah. Do I have books? I have many. Yeah. There are many great books on the topic. I was just thinking, I should have looked to come up with some good books to read. I had a top five. I'll have to look on my phone to see if I can find them. So the books, a great book is, if you just want like a great intelligent design book, Darwin's Black Box is a great book. Let me pull up a website and I will tell you. Yes, is that the one with all the different essays? Yes, that book is awesome. The Global Flood. There's one about Genesis. Let me pull up the...
I think you're starting, though. I would start with the movie.
Yes. Answers in Genesis. Like, that is such a fantastic... And if you want more, you can buy the 3-DVD set that has 14 hours of additional interview. Because that material, if you want to just start with video material, Answers in Genesis is Genesis History is the place to go. And you can actually, I think, find it for free on YouTube. So I would watch Is Genesis History is the place to start. And then if you want more, buy those DVDs. But those are a couple of great books. Let me pull up, I had a list of books. I should have looked it up. Because I thought somebody would ask me that question. Other questions while I'm working on that. A couple great books. Just from creation.com, the Creation Answers book is a great book. They have a great book on design. What's it called? By Design. So that's the fancy like color version. There's a cheaper older version that just goes through like 100 examples of amazing design in creation. Let's see. What else? But if you want anthropology, Bones of Contention by Lubinow. I remember he came years ago to talk at CSU. It's a bit more on the technical side for anthropology. Yes. Yep. So. Those would be good places to start. And then you can find lots of other stuff. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yep.
I think I just did a little bit of research. When you look up like proof for a old universe, a lot of it is kind of cosmological, space-time kind of stuff. As for your general thoughts there, specifically because as I look for a creationist response, I've seen kind of like different routes this take. Some are we don't understand cosmology, like either side doesn't understand it, so it doesn't really prove it. Others will argue no, cosmology does prove creationism. I don't know, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so it's not my area of expertise, but I'll tell you some general thoughts. First is that we are not the only ones with the problem. The Big Bang has the universe expanding faster than the speed of light for a significant chunk of our history. How do they explain that? They don't. They can't. It doesn't fit in their model. Actually, their model is breaking down. Virtually every story from the new James Webb telescope, if you go read every science story on that telescope, says scientists see something that shouldn't exist. Scientists see something that doesn't fit the model. Everything we see, we've never seen anything like we expected. So everything that they're seeing doesn't fit their model, because what they're doing is they're looking back in time and seen fully formed old galaxies. And so their model doesn't work. Now, what's the model for us, right? And so this is the what they call the time-light problem. And it is a challenging problem. There are a variety of explanations. Which is correct? I don't know. We're into the realm of, getting into the realm of theoretical physics stuff, which is a realm of, somewhat make-believe. I don't know. People who do physics, it's make-believe. We make up stuff and make theories. My friend Nick, who's a physics major, doesn't think that. But there's a variety of different explanations. One is that God created the light mature, like he created the universe mature. Some people don't like that because that would mean light. We're seeing light from things that didn't actually happen. Some would say that the universe is created out of a white hole, which is the opposite of a black hole, which theoretically is possible. Don't really have a way to prove that. Some say that the speed of light is actually slower now than it used to be. There's some arguments for that. Others, there's a great chapter in this book called The Created Cosmos. It's written by a PhD astronomer, and it's all just about stars and astronomy. He has a whole chapter on this. His idea is, it's something with a D is what he calls it, is that just like God, when he created the trees, it says they grew, like rapid. I don't know if you ever read, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where in The Magician's Nephew, where he creates the world in existence, things grow really rapidly. That's the sense you get from Genesis for like how he created trees, things like that. And that's his idea, is that things rapidly expanded. And honestly, the relativity could potentially explain some of this if we were kind of at the center and we stayed relatively still and everything else moved really fast. Or if we moved really fast. Again, this is not my expertise. If we moved really fast and they move, anyway, I don't know. But so are we going to find an explanation that totally explains it? I don't know. Do we have a variety of reasonable explanations for it? I think we do. And again, it gets back to what we talked about. And I remember, I think Josh said it. We're not going to get an answer to every single question that's going to be perfect. But we're going to get enough answers to all the questions that's going to help us to make a decision. So, yes, that is a challenging problem. And lots of really smart people have written a lot of stuff, some of which I don't understand because I'm not a physics guy. So, yes, please do. And you'll find different people with different ideas on how to make sense of that. So. Any questions? Yes.
You said that some species, like the walrus, definitely they weren't like all on the farm, but like some of them also started originally. Like, to what extent to what extent did all the species like evolve? Like how many of them just like made like
Yeah, so that's a question we don't know the answer to. There are smart people who've tried to figure that out. If you go to the Ark Encounter, they tried to figure that in Kentucky, which is a really cool thing to go to. They tried to figure out how many kinds of animals would you have to have in the Ark. And I don't remember the number, but it's not a crazy number. We don't actually know how related some things are. We have a pretty good idea for dogs. We have a pretty good idea for cats. We have a pretty good idea for some sets of animals. Other animals, it's harder to know, particularly ones that are extinct. And so it's hard to know the answer to how many animals were before that. Presumably, there was even more diversity. But it's really unknown because God just brought one pair of each kind. And so were there a whole bunch more diversity that we lost in the flood? Probably, but we don't know. So, but smart people have tried to figure, I don't remember the number for that. Yeah. So, it's all doable in the Ark. If you go with like younger animals and So you don't have to bring every single kind of everything. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, good question. I was just reading something about this is saltwater and freshwater fish. Yeah. How can freshwater and saltwater fish survive in this environment? So a couple different thoughts on this. Just read something about this. So over time, if you slowly expose freshwater fish to salt, they adapt. And if you express saltwater fish to freshwater, slowly they adapt. And so you can't like just throw them in there or they will die. But you don't know how quickly the conditions changed. We don't quite know the conditions before the flood. Also, I don't know if you've ever been to places like this where we went to a place like this once in Hawaii where fresh water comes out of the volcanic rock, and because it has a different density, it layers on top of the salt water. And so I remember there was this layer of like 2.5 feet of super cold fresh water on top, and below it was this warm layer of salt water that were totally separate. One was fresh, one was salt. And so maybe was some of that occurring? We don't know. But, you know, while the animals may have adapted, over time, that may have occurred. There may have been a slow mixing. I think those are some of the explanations. And then the animals, you know, animals are really good at adapting to their conditions. So. Yeah.
Can you explain how mutations work?
Oh, yeah. So mutations. Mutations are supposed to be the engine of evolution. So mutations occur in your DNA because your DNA, whenever you make a new cell, gets copied, all 3 billion base pairs. And it has a really good repair system, but it's not perfect. So sometimes there are errors. Sometimes you get errors because of radiation. Sometimes you get errors because things sort wrong. And so the idea of mutations is, of Darwinian mutations, is that over time mutations accumulate. Some of these mutations are beneficial. Those beneficial mutations are selected for. Those organisms survive better. They pass on their beneficial mutations, and evolution happens. So that's the idea behind mutations. The problem with mutations is like 95% of mutations are totally neutral and do nothing. Some small percent are lethal, and some small percent are potentially maybe slightly advantageous. The problem is when 95%, and again, I'm not a population geneticist. There are guys who get PhDs in population genetics where they calculate out how long does it take to get these established. And so actually, if you do the math, and if you watch that Dismantled movie, they do a fantastic job of going through this, of making the point that to establish one beneficial mutation in a population actually takes longer than like the existence of the universe. Than the time the universe has been in existence. So, or maybe it's 8 beneficial mutations, but to have all of the changes to say go from, I went to the museum up here. They have a great diagram of whale evolution, starting from this little ratty shrewy thing, turning into a whale. How many mutations do you think it would take to turn a rat shrew into a whale? Right? You got to be able to like breathe out of the top of your head, hold your breath for hours, sustain like being able to swim underwater, hundreds of pounds of pressure. You have to get flippers instead of legs. I mean, that's hundreds of changes. And so if you just do the math using population genetics, there's not enough time in the universe to do it. So, and that's what that Dismantled movie does, a fantastic job. They have about a 10-minute bit where they go through all this. There's some guys called John Sanford and Rob Carter who've done a bunch of this population genetic studies. Super fantastic articles on this where they go through a lot of these things. Again, population genetics, not really my expertise. It's a lot of math and formulas. But yeah, So that's how mutations work. But most mutations are bad. Although the example evolutionists will usually give as what's good, they'll say, well, sickle cell anemia. That's a mutation that's good. So I don't know if you guys know about sickle cell anemia. So sickle cell anemia is a mutation in hemoglobin that primarily people of African American descent have. And the advantage of sickle cell anemia is it makes it harder for malaria parasites to live in your red blood cells. The problem with sickle cell anemia is it's also, if you get two mutations, it's very bad for you. You get infarcts, your blood cells sickle and block off blood vessels. It's bad for people. But if you live in Africa where there's lots of malaria, having one mutation in that is advantageous. But it's not like a gain of function mutation. It's actually an error mutation that if it expands is actually detrimental to the population. But there are things going on in that population that select for it that make people who have this mutation survive better than those who don't. But I would not consider breaking a system to make it so you don't die as much a sort of progression to being a fitter organism. That's not a fitter organism. That's just an organism that is better adapted to its environment. And that is the story when you look at natural selection over and over again. I mentioned the polar bear. The polar bear actually has, I think, I can't remember, it was 8 or 12 different genetic, 12 differences from, like, say, a typical brown bear. It's, like, adapted to eating blubber and has white fur and a bunch of other metabolic stuff. But every single one of those is a loss of function or a change, a damaging mutation, where if it went back into its old environment where the brown bears live, it would not survive as well. And there is no model for positive genetic changes. There's just not. You can't, like, create new stuff. You can fiddle-faddle around with it and make it fit the environment better, but you don't have a way of creating new stuff. So it kind of is. I don't like to use that argument because the evolutionists will often come back and say, well, with energy input in closed systems, you can increase structure and function, which is true. The guys who, again, Sanford and Carter wrote, Sanford particularly wrote this book called Genetic Entropy, which is that concept that our genetic system is winding down, i.e. my kids have more mutations than I do and more mutations than my parents. And our genetic code is not getting better. Sorry, young people, it's actually getting worse with every single generation. Despite Elias thinking he's getting stronger and better, it's getting worse. And that's the whole argument. If you read that book, Genetic Entropy, and they present a very convincing, I think, argument that we are winding down, not on the trajectory up, which is what we should be if evolution were true. We are on the trajectory down. I think the most challenging one to answer is one we talked about. The time light problem is hard. I don't know that that's challenging to, like, my faith. I think what was challenging overall was just, like, the whole evolutionary story and not having resources, defense, anything to, like, come against it. That's where I think you guys are so fortunate. You have so much material. It's like a Google search away, finding just reams of fantastic stuff. So, and you know, the time light doesn't challenge my faith. It's one small, like, detail point that I'm not quite sure on, but I can live with one small detail point because the rest of it all, I mean, the question is which fits better. I think the creation model fits so much better to reality, which is what we want. What? What do you mean?
Like, are animals, like, getting worse versus, like, the next animal getting more mutations too?
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. Mostly people have talked about it in population genetics for humans, but I'm sure it's the case in it. So it is the case. So cheetahs are a great example. So cheetah's population has gotten very small. What's the problem when you get a very small population? The genetics start to fall apart. And so we're seeing that in animal populations, particularly when they get small, that they fall apart as well. So I think the same thing does happen in animals as well.
This question was about if the nuclear bombs.
Oh, if the nuclear bombs did it?
Because I personally don't believe that, like, the whole human's nuclear theory, but, like, how would you counter
Oh, that humans are what's doing it?
Yeah.
What evidence do you have that says that? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you get more radiation from cosmic radiation, frankly, than anything from, like, nuclear bombs or nuclear waste. Or, I mean, unless you're hanging around it. I mean, you're going to get way more radiation, cosmic radiation. I mean, that's what causes mutations, is cosmic radiation, and just copy errors. So, I mean, that's the main, you know, cause of genetic errors, is just copy errors. The system is really, really good, but it's not perfect. Other questions? Yes.
From the topic of animals, I know scientists are starting to take, you know, these different DNA that they find of animals, and they're growing them in the lab, and now they're actually starting to produce some of these animals that are supposed to be extinct.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, do you feel like that's biblical?
That's a good question. So I think animals are a different case than humans. I would be very against anything like that with humans. I think we're really messing around with what God created and said is made in his image. And when we start monkeying around with that, I think those are very ethically challenging areas. But I think that's where it's some of those things you have to think through. What do they mean for animals? Again, I think you have to be careful. If Jurassic World taught us anything, your Jurassic Park. Yes, but I mean, from a like morality standpoint, if you had the DNA for a dodo bird and wanted to bring it back, I don't have a problem with it. I don't know that they'll be able to bring it fully back because they have to usually build those on a scaffold of other animals. Again, like Jurassic Park, they built it on the frog or whatever. But they usually do have to build it on the scaffold because they don't have all of it. They have to use other animal genes in there. And so whether they'll actually be able to do it, I don't know. For something like, I saw they were going to bring back the dire wolf. Well, that shouldn't be too hard, right? Because you got dogs and you got wolves. And so you just throw a couple other genes in there, and you got your dire wolf. So, yeah.
So you think you can add dinosaurs?
Potentially, yeah. So. Anything else? Yes. Yeah. I mean, that would be my presumption, is that Noah took dinosaurs on the ark. And then they just died out in the environment that we have now. I mean, I think you could make the argument that maybe there were dinosaurs. And we had a question back at the beginning, maybe you weren't here, that maybe there were dinosaurs off the ark. There's a lot of pictures that'd be suggestive of maybe there were dinosaurs. I don't think there are anymore. But that would be my presumption, is that he took dinosaurs on the ark and they've since gone extinct. Now, a whole bunch of them died in the flood. But, you know, he says he took every kind. And so presumably dinosaurs are part of that. And we don't, because we don't have dinosaurs now, we don't know how many kinds that was and, you know, how related were all the dinosaurs. We don't know. And I mentioned this at the beginning. I mean, I think Job describes dinosaurs. When he talks about the Leviathan and the Behemoth, I think he's talking about dinosaurs. I mean, what he describes sure sounds like a brontosaurus or a some big sauropod when he describes the behemoth. I mean, you go look at that in the museum over here. It's got tree trunks, legs like tree trunks, and big long tail, just like described in Job. So, I mean, it sure seems like that to me. Yeah. So, this is a great question that I didn't get a chance to talk about. So is a day a day? The question is about how long is a day? What does the Hebrew word of day mean? So that word is, I think, yom. I'm no Hebraist, but I've read a bunch and watched a bunch of stuff. So the way that they use the word day is the same way we use the word day. A day could mean a 24-hour period. A day could also mean like a time period, like back in the day of President Biden. That's not a 24-hour period. That's a general time period. And so then you have to interpret the word in the context and also look at it as it's used in other places. And so that word in Genesis, when you read it, boy, it sure seems like it's talking about a 24-hour period because it says there was evening, there was morning, the third day. There's evening, there's morning, the fourth day. And so it's giving us this light-dark cycle with a day. And then in Exodus, where God talks about it, right, where he talks about how, you know, 6 days you'll labor, one day you'll have the Sabbath, just like I created in 6 days and took a day off. And so, you know, the context that God interpreted it in was single days. At least that certainly seems how it is. And there's nothing that would suggest that it's an age in the text. Some people would cite, you know, Peter that says, you know, with God, a day is like an age, an age is like a day. But that's in reference to when is Christ returning, when is the judgment, not necessarily addressing how long is a day. And so that like day age would be how a lot of the old earth people explain it. The problem is if you look at like the order that things are created in, they still don't fit the evolutionary order. And so they, like, the animals show up in the wrong order, like the birds and the fish show up, and then the animals. But the birds are supposed to evolve from the animals. So, it doesn't really work to fit in that model. So that would be my understanding. Again, they go through that whole thing in Is Genesis History. They actually talk about that whole thing. So, yes, go for it, John.
But every time it's numbered in the Bible, it's always a 24-hour, like first, second, third, fourth. It's always 24 hours, and every sequential, it's always 24. So a number is linked to 24, sequential is linked to 24, plus the day and the night.
Yep. Great. Oh, great question. Great question. So the question is, there was evening and morning the second day, and God doesn't create the sun until what? Day four, I think it is. Is that right? Day four? Day three? Day four. So that's a great question. So where does the light come from? Clearly after that, it comes from the sun and moon, but God has established this like light-dark cycle. Where is the light going to come from in the new creation? It's going to come from God himself. He says there'll be no sun. God will be the light. And so did God create? Was he the light? And there was this light dark cycle. I don't know if we're going to quite know the answer to that. I don't know if you have other thoughts on that, Josh. That's kind of my interpretation. But that is a good question. So, but that's the explanation I've heard most. And I think it makes sense to me. So. Questions? You guys are asking great questions. Thinking the right thing. Yes.
I want to say that the universe is like rapidly expanding, like still like just every second. Do you think that's like God is like creating, like, I don't know, more and more like of the universe, or is that just like, is that a thing?
No, I think the universe is expanding, and actually the expanding universe was a real problem for the establishment science, because what had been believed for many, many years was the eternal universe. The universe is all there is, all there's ever been. It's always been stable. But if the universe is expanding, that means it must have expanded from some point earlier. And when you walk it back, that's where we get to that singularity. And so that actually, the expanding universe was not liked by many scientists. And in fact, Einstein, when he came up with his cosmologic constant, he actually didn't agree with that. And he actually, when he did the constant and the math, he actually fudged it so that it didn't show an expanding universe. But after, I think, 5 or 7 years, Hubble, who we have the space telescope named after him, actually proved through like redshift and other things, the universe was expanding, is expanding. And so Einstein's like, well, yeah, okay, the universe isn't eternal, it is expanding. But he did that because he didn't like the philosophical implications of a universe that had a beginning. Because if something has a beginning, you have to ask the question of why, what started it? Why did it happen? I think there, it you know, brings up lots of great philosophical questions. So, Elias?
How do you think it is expanding?
Yeah, that's a great. I've heard different opinions from different people, and I don't know the answer. The scientists do not want us to be at the center of the universe. They never want anything that would make us special or unique in any way. But I've, you know, some people think that's the case. I don't honestly know the answer to that question. It wouldn't surprise me if we are the center. But I don't think the scientists would ever say that, because that would make us too special. And they don't like special.
Okay. Great job. Great question.
Yes, good question.